Saturday, Disc 7.
Perrone is well into his third glass of champagne. A big mistake. He's not a practiced drinker, but he's viciously happy. It's not just Iraq. I'm talking about Syria, Iran, Saudi Arabia, a great swathe of repression, corruption, and misery. You're about to be a published writer. Why not let it bother you a little, the censorship, and your fellow writers in Arab jails, in the very region where writing was invented? Or is freedom and not being tortured a Western affectation we shouldn't impose on others? Oh, for God's sake, not that relativist stuff again. And you keep drifting off the point. No one wants Arab writers in jail, but invading Iraq isn't going to get them out. It might. Here's a chance to turn one country around. Plant a seed. See if it flourishes and spreads. You don't plant seeds with cruise missiles. They're going to hate the invaders. The religious extremists will get stronger. There'll be less freedom, more writers in prison. My £50 says 3 months after the invasion there'll be a free press in Iraq and unmonitored internet access too. The reformers in Iran will be encouraged, though Syrian and Saudi and Libyan potentates will be getting the jitters. Daisy says, fine. And my 50 says it'll be a mess, and even you will wish it never happened. They had various bets after arguments during her teenage years, generally concluded with a mock formal handshake. Perrone found a way of paying up even when he won, a form of concealed subsidy. After an exam seemed to go badly for her, 17-year-old Daisy angrily put £20 on never getting into Oxford. To cheer her up, he raised his side of the deal to £500, and when her acceptance came through, she spent the money on a trip to Florence with a friend. Is she in the mood for shaking hands now? She comes away from the door, retrieves her champagne and moves to the far side of the kitchen and appears interested in Theo's CDs by the hi-fi. Her back is firmly turned on him. He remains on his stool at the centre island, playing with his glass, no longer drinking. He has a hollow feeling from arguing only a half of what he feels. He's a dove with Jay Strauss and a hawk with his daughter. What sense is he making? And how luxurious to work it all out at home in the kitchen, the geopolitical moves and military strategy, and not be held to account by voters, newspapers, friends, history. When there are no consequences, being wrong is simply an interesting diversion. She takes a CD from its box and posts it in the player. He waits, knowing he'll get a clue to her mood or even a message. At the piano intro, he smiles. It's a record Theo brought into the house years ago. Chuck Berry's old pianist, Johnny Johnson, singing Tanqueray, a slouching blues of reunion and friendship. It was a long time coming, but I knew I would see the day when you and I could sit down and have a drink of Tanqueray. She turns and comes towards him with a little dance shuffle. When she's at his side, he takes her hand. She says, "Smells like the old warmonger's made one of his fish stews. Can I be of use?" "The young appeaser can set the table and make a salad dressing if you like." She's on her way to the plate cupboard when they hear the doorbell. Two overlong, unsteady rings. They look at each other. It's not promising, that kind of persistence. He says, "Before you do that, slice a lemon. The gin's over there, tonic's in the fridge." He's amused by her theatrical eye-rolling and deep breath. "Here goes. Stay cool," he advises, and goes upstairs to greet his father-in-law, the eminent poet. Growing up in the suburbs in cosily shared solitude with his mother, Henry Perrone never felt the lack of a father. In the heavily mortgaged households around him, fathers were distant, work-worn figures of little obvious interest. To a child, a domestic existence in Perivale in the mid-60s was regulated uniquely by a mother, a housewife. Visiting a friend's house to play at weekends or holidays, it was her domain you entered, her rules you temporarily lived by. She was the one who gave or withheld permission or handed out the small change. He had no good reason to envy his friends an extra parent. When fathers weren't absent, they loomed irascibly, preventing rather than enabling the better, riskier elements of life. In his teens, when he scrutinized the few existing photographs of his father, it was less out of longing than narcissism. He hoped to discover in those strong, acne-free features some promise for his own future chances with girls. He wanted the face, but he didn't want the advice, the refusals, or the judgments. Perhaps he was bound to regard a father-in-law as an imposition, even if he'd acquired one far less imposing than John Grammaticus. Right from their first meeting in 1982, when he arrived at the chateau hours after consummating his love for Rosalind on a lower bunk on the Bilbao ferry, Senior House Officer Perrone was determined not to be patronised, not to be treated like a prospective son. He was an adult with specialised skills that could stand alongside those of any poet. Through Rosalind, he knew of Mount Fuji, the much-anthologised Grammaticus poem, but Henry didn't read poetry and said so without shame at dinner that first night. At that time, John was deep into his No Exequies, his last extended creative period, as it turned out, and what some junior doctor didn't read in his spare time failed to intrigue him. Nor did he seem to care, or even notice, later when the scotch was on the table, the same doctor disagreeing with him on politics — Grammaticus was an early fan of Mrs. Thatcher — or music — bebop had betrayed jazz — or the true nature of the French, venal to a man. Rosalind said the next morning that Henry had tried too hard to get the old man's attention, the opposite of what he intended, and a very irritating remark. But even though he ceased to be argumentative, nothing much changed between them after that first evening, even after marriage, children, and the passing of more than two decades. Perrone keeps his distance, and Grammaticus is happy with the arrangement, and looks straight through his son-in-law to his daughter, to his grandchildren. The two men are superficially friendly and at bottom bored by each other. Perrone can't see how poetry, rather occasional work it appears, like grape-picking, can occupy a whole working life, or how such an edifice of reputation and self-regard can rest on so little, or why one should believe a drunk poet is different from any other drunk. While Grammaticus, Perrone's guess, regards him as one more tradesman, an uncultured and tedious medic, a class of men and women he distrusts more as his dependency on it grows with age. There's another matter, naturally, never discussed. The house on the square, like the chateau, came to Rosalind's mother Marianne through her parents. When she married Grammaticus, the London house became the family home where Rosalind and her brother grew up. When Marianne died in the road accident, the terms of her will were clear. The London house passed to the children, and John was to have Saint-Félix. 4 years after they were married, Rosalind and Henry, living in a tiny flat in Archway, raised a mortgage to buy out her brother, who wanted an apartment in New York. It was a joyful day when the Perrones and their two young children moved into the big house. These various transactions were made without ill will. But Grammaticus tends to behave on his occasional visits as if he's returning home, as if he were an absentee landlord greeting his tenants, asserting his rights. Or perhaps Henry is too sensitive, having no place in his constitution for a father figure. Either way, it irks him. He prefers to see his father-in-law, if at all, in France. As he goes towards the front door, Perrone reminds himself, against the promptings of the champagne, to keep his feelings well disguised. The purpose of the evening is to reconcile Daisy to her grandfather 3 years on from what Theo has named, in honour of various thrillers, The Newdigate rebuff. She'll want to show him the proofs, and the old man should rightfully claim his part in her success. On that good thought, he opens the door to see Grammatica several feet away, standing in the road with long belted woolen coat, fedora and cane, head tipped back, his features in profile caught in the cool white light from the lamps in the square. Most likely he was posing for Daisy.
"Ah, Henry," he says.
The disappointment is in the downward inflection.
"I was looking at the tower."
Grammaticus doesn't shift position, so Perrone obligingly steps out to join him.
"I was trying to see it," he continues, "through the eyes of Robert Adam when he was setting out the square, wondering what he would have made of it. What do you think?"
It rises above the plane trees in the central gardens, behind the reconstructed facade on the southern side. Set high on the glass-paned stalk, six stacked circular terraces bearing their giant dishes, and above them, a set of fat wheels or sleeves within which is bound the geometry of fluorescent lights. At night, the dancing mercury is a playful touch. When he was small, Theo liked to ask whether the tower would hit the house if it fell their way, and was always gratified when his father told him it most certainly would. Since Perrone and Grammaticus have not yet greeted each other or shaken hands, their conversation is disembodied, like a chat room exchange. Perrone, the courteous host, joins in the game.
"Well, he might have taken an engineer's view. All that glass and the unsupported height would have amazed him. So would the electric light. He might have thought of it more as a machine than a building."
Grammaticus indicates that this is not the answer at all.
"The truth is, his only analogy at the end of the 18th century would have been a cathedral spire. He was bound to think of it as a religious building of some kind. Why else build so high? He'd have to assume those dishes were ornamental or used in rites. A religion of the future?
In which case, not far out." Grammaticus raises his voice to speak over him.
"For God's sake, man, look at the proportions of those pillars, the carving on those capitals."
Now he's jabbing his cane towards the facade on the square's east side.
"There's beauty for you. There's self-knowledge. A different world. A different consciousness. Adam would have been stunned by the ugliness of that glass thing. No human scale, top-heavy, no grace, no warmth. It would have put fear in his heart. If that's going to be our religion, he'd have said to himself, then we're truly fucked."
Their view of the Georgian pillars of the east facade includes in the foreground two figures on a bench about 100 feet away wearing leather jackets and woolen watch caps. Their backs are turned, and they're sitting close together, hunched forward, so that Perrone assumes that a deal is in progress. Why else sit out here so intently on a cold February night? Sudden impatience comes over him. Before Grammaticus can continue to damn the civilization they share, or exult in another well out of their reach, he says,
"Daisy's waiting for you. She's making you a powerful drink."
He takes his father-in-law's elbow and shoves him gently in the direction of the wide, brightly lit open door. John is well into his expansive, relatively benign stage, and Daisy shouldn't miss it. Reconciliation won't be a theme of the later phases. He takes his father-in-law's coat, stick and hat, shows him into the sitting room, and goes to call down to Daisy. She's already on her way up with a tray. A new bottle of champagne as well as the old, the gin, ice, lemon, extra glasses for Rosalind and Theo, and macadamia nuts in the painted bowl she brought back from a student trip to Chile. When she gives him a querying look, he makes a cheerful face. It's going to be fine. Thinking she and her grandfather are bound to embrace, he takes the tray and follows her in. But Grammaticus, who's standing in the centre of the room, draws himself up rather formally and Daisy holds back. It could be he's surprised by her beauty, just as Henry himself was, or struck by her familiarity. They go towards each other, murmuring respectively.
Daisy.
Grandad.
Shake hands, and then by a compact enforced by the movement of their bodies, which they can't reverse once it's begun, they awkwardly kiss cheeks. Henry sets down the tray and mixes a gin and tonic.
Here you are, he says. Let's raise a glass. To poetry.
The old man's hand, he notices, is shaking as he takes his gin. Lifting their glasses, humming or grunting without quite repeating the words a mere bone-setter has no right to utter, Daisy and her grandfather drink. Grammaticus says to him,
She's the image of Mariam when I first met her.
His eyes, Perrone notes, are not moist like his own were. Despite the passion and the mood reversals, there's something controlled and untouchable, even steely, about Grammaticus. He has a way of sailing through encounters, of being lofty, even in close company. Long ago, according to Rosalind, in his 30s, he developed the manner of the old and grand, of not caring what anybody thinks. Daisy says to him,
You look awfully well.
He puts his hand on her arm.
I reread them all in the hotel this afternoon. Bloody marvellous, Daisy. There's no one like you.
He drinks again, and quotes in a curious sing-song,
My saucy bark, inferior far to his, on your broad main doth bravely appear.
He's twinkly, and teasing her the way he used to.
Now, be honest. Who is the other poet with talent the size of a galleon?
Grammaticus is fishing for the tribute he believes must be his by right. A little too soon in the evening. He's going too fast. It's quite possible that Daisy has dedicated her book to her grandfather, although Perrone has worries about that. Another reason why he wanted to see the proofs. Daisy is confused. She goes to speak, changes her mind, and then says through a forced smile,
You'll just have to wait and see.
Of course, Shakespeare didn't really think he was a little sailing boat among the ocean-going competition. He was trying it on, being sardonic. So, perhaps you are too, my dear girl.
She's hesitant, embarrassed, struggling with a decision. She hides behind her raised glass. Then she puts it down on the table and seems to make up her mind.
Grandad, it's not doth bravely appear.
Of course it is. I taught you that sonnet.
I know you did, but how can the line scan with bravely? It's on your broad main doth willfully appear.
The twinkle in Grammaticus simply vanishes. His rigid gaze rests on his granddaughter and she glares back, just the way she did at her father in the kitchen. She's spoken up in a spirit of disloyalty, and she's standing her ground. For Henry, the word scan triggers an unwanted memory. A prick of work anxiety about £190,000 shortfall in the funds the trust has set aside for the purchase of a more powerful MRI scanner. He's written the memo, he's been to all the meetings. Was there something else he should have done? An email to be forwarded, perhaps. Of scanning in poetry, he's in no position to say that willfully is an improvement on bravely. Grammaticus says,
Well, there you go. It doesn't scan. How about that? Henry, how are things at the hospital?
In more than 20 years, he's never asked about the hospital, and Henry can't permit his daughter to be brushed aside. At the same time, it's wondrous. 3 years apart, and these two are falling out within the minute. He gives a plausible impression of being amused in saying lightly to Grammaticus,
My own memory plays far worse tricks than that.
Then he turns to Daisy. She's backed off a pace and looks like she might be searching for an excuse to leave the room. He's determined to keep her there.
Clear this up for me. How is it willfully scans and bravely doesn't?
She's perfectly good-natured, explaining the facts of life to her father and rubbing it in for Grammaticus.
On your broad main doth willfully appear is 5 feet, 5 iams. You know, tee-tum, weak-strong. There are always 5 in this kind of line. Bravely would leave it a beat short, and it wouldn't sound right.
While she's speaking, Grammaticus is lowering himself onto one of the leather sofas with a conspicuous groan that partly obliterates her final words. He says,
"Don't be too hard on an old man. It was no dream. I lay broad waking. Plenty of short lines in Shakespeare, dozens of them in the sonnets. If he'd written bravely, we'd make the bugger scan."
"That's bloody Wyatt,"
Daisy murmurs below the old man's hearing. Perrone glances at her and raises a covert finger. She's won her point and surely knows she should let her grandfather have the last word, unless she wants to fight on until dinner and beyond.
"I suppose you're right. We would. More gin, Grandad."
There's no audible edge in her voice. Grammaticus passes her his glass.
"I'll do the tonic myself."
When that's done, Daisy lets a few seconds pass for the silence to neutralize, then murmurs to her father, "I'll go and finish the table." Perhaps Henry's too preoccupied or too impatient to make a decent job of this reunion. Does it matter? If Daisy has outgrown one more tutor in her life, what's he supposed to do about that? There's a change in her he doesn't understand, a certain agitation that keeps fading into a smoothness of manner, a degree of combativeness that rises and retreats. And he doesn't wish to be left alone drinking with his father-in-law. He longs for Rosalind to arrive home with all her homely skills, the mothers, daughters, wives, lawyers. He says to Daisy, "I'd love to see this proof copy."
"All right."
Perrone sits on the other sofa, facing Grammaticus across the scarred, polished tarket table, and pushes the nuts towards him. They listen to her softly cursing as she rummages in her backpack in the hall. Neither man can be troubled with small talk. Even if they could agree on what's worthwhile talking about, neither would have any interest in the other's opinion. So they remain in contented silence. Sitting down comfortably for the first time since he entered the house, his feet delightfully relieved of his weight, his mood enhanced by wine and 3 glasses of champagne on an empty stomach, his hearing still faintly impaired by Theo's band, his thighs aching again from the squash, Perrone abandons himself to a gentle swell of dissociation. Nothing matters much. Whatever's been troubling him is benignly resolved. The pilots are harmless Russians, Lily is well cared for, Daisy is home with her book, those 2 million marchers are good-hearted souls. Theo and Chaz have written a fine song. Rosalind will win her case on Monday and is on her way. It's statistically improbable that terrorists will murder his family tonight. His stew, he suspects, might be one of his best. All the patients on next week's list will come through. Grammaticus means well, really. And tomorrow, Sunday, we'll deliver Henry and Rosalind into a morning of sleep and sensuality. Now is the moment to pour another glass. He's reaching for the bottle and checking his father-in-law's drink when they hear a loud metallic jiggling from the hall, a scream from Daisy, a baritone shout of, "Yo!" followed by the thunderous slam of the front door, which sends concentric ripples through the poet's gin. Then a soft thud and grunt of bodies colliding. Theo is home and embracing his sister. Seconds later, entering the sitting room hand in hand, the children present a tableau of their respective obsessions and careers. Precious gifts, Henry unjealously concedes, from their grandfather. Daisy holds a copy of her bound proof. Her brother grips his guitar in its case by the neck. Of all the family, Theo is by far the most relaxed with grammaticas. They have their music in common and there's no competition. Theo plays, his grandfather listens and tends his blues archive, now being transferred to hard disk with the boy's help. "Granddad, don't get up," he calls as he leans his guitar against the wall. But the old man is getting to his feet as Theo comes over, and the two hug without inhibition. Daisy comes and sits beside her father and slides her book into his lap. Grammaticus has hold of his grandson's arm and is enlivened, rejuvenated by his presence.
"So, you've a new song for me."
The proof is aquamarine with black lettering. As he stares at the title and its author's name, Perrone slips his arm around his daughter's shoulders and squeezes, and she moves closer to him to see her book through his eyes. He sees it through hers and tries to imagine the thrill. At her age, he was a swatting fifth-year medical student in a universe of Latin names and corporeal facts, far removed from such possibilities. With his free hand, he turns to the title page and together they read the three words again. And this time, they're bound within a double-edged rectangle. "My saucy bark, Daisy Perrone." And, at the foot of the page, the publisher's name followed by London, Boston. Her boat, of whatever size, is launched upon the transatlantic currents. Theo is saying something and he looks up.
"Dad! Dad! The song! What did you think?"
When the children were tiny, one took care with the even distribution of praise. These high-achieving kids. He should have been discussing the song earlier when he was alone with Grammaticus. But Henry needed his drifting half-minute of positive thinking. He says,
"I was swept away."
And to everyone's surprise, he tips his chin towards the ceiling and sings with tolerable accuracy,
"Let me take you there, my city square, city square."
Theo takes from his coat pocket a CD and gives it to his grandfather. "We made a recording this afternoon. It's not perfect, but you'll get the idea." Henry returns his attention to his daughter.
"I like this London, Boston. Very classy."
He traces the tiny block capitals with his finger. Over the page he reads with relief the dedication. "To John Grammaticus." In sudden anguish, Daisy is whispering in his ear,
"I don't know if it's right. It should have been to you and Mum. I just didn't know what to do."
He squeezes her again and murmurs,
"It's exactly right."
"I don't know if it is. I can still change it."
"He puts you on the path. It makes perfect sense.
He's going to be very happy."
"We all are. You did the right thing."
And then, in case there's any trace of regret in his voice, he adds,
"There'll be other books too. You can work your way round the whole family."
Only then is he aware, from tremors in her form huddled up against his own and a flush of body warmth, that she's crying. She pushes her face into his upper arm. Theo and his grandfather are in the other part of the room by the CD shelves, discussing a boogie pianist.
"Hey, little one," he says into her ear. "What is it, my darling?"
She cries harder, soundlessly, and shakes her head, unable to talk. "Shall we go upstairs to the library?" She shakes her head again and he strokes her hair and waits.
Unhappy in love?
He tries to resist speculation. There's no particular instance from her childhood he can remember, but it's a vaguely familiar experience from long ago, waiting for her to recover and tell him what's making her cry. She was always eloquent. All those novels she read as a child, especially after her grandfather took her in hand, schooled her in the accurate description of feelings. Henry leans back and patiently, lovingly holds his daughter. She's no longer tearful, but she continues to press her head into his shoulder and her eyes are closed. Her book lies open on his lap, still at the dedication page. Behind him, Theo and his grandfather are discussing recordings and personnel, and like true devotees, they speak in murmurs, making the room feel calm. Grammaticus has another gin in his hand, his third perhaps, but is eerily sober. Perrone feels pins and needles moving along his upper arm where Daisy's head is pressing. He looks down at her fondly, at what little he can see of her face. Not even the first traces of aging or experience around the corner of her visible eye. Only clean, taut skin, faintly purple, like the peripheries of a bruise. The outward show, the new toys of sexual development obscure the fact that childhood tails away slowly. Daisy had breasts and periods when her bed was still so stuffed with teddy bears and other soft animals there was barely room for her. Then it was a first bank account, a university degree, a driving license that concealed the lingering, fading child which only a parent can still recognize in the newly formed adult. But watching her now, he knows that however she cuddles against his side, this is no innocent. It's likely her mind is turning fast, faster than his can, perhaps around a broken mosaic of recent events. Raised voices in rooms, flashes of Parisian streets, an open suitcase on an unmade bed, whatever is distressing her. You stare at a head, a lushness of hair, and can only guess. This second dreamy interlude may have lasted 5 minutes, perhaps 10. At one point, as the logic of his thoughts begins to disintegrate, he closes his eyes and lets himself drift backwards and down, a pleasant sensation confused with notions of a muddy tidal river and of untying with clumsy fingers a knotted rope that is also a means of converting currency and changing weekends into work days. But even as he sinks, he knows he mustn't sleep. There are guests and other responsibilities he can't immediately identify. At the sound of Rosalind opening the front door, he stirs and looks expectantly across his left shoulder. Daisy, too, half raises her head, and the conversation between Theo and Grammaticus breaks off. There's an unusually long pause before they hear from the hall the sound of the door closing. Perrone thinks his wife might be burdened with shopping or packages or legal bundles, and is about to get up to help when she comes in. She moves slowly, stiffly, apparently wary of what she is about to find. She's carrying her brown leather briefcase and she's pale. Her face is stretched, as though invisible hands are compressing and pulling the skin back towards her ears. Her eyes are wide and dark, desperate to communicate what her lips, parting and closing once, are unable to tell them. They watch as she stops and looks back at the doorway she has come through. "Mum?" Daisy calls out to her. Perrone disentangles himself from his daughter and rises to his feet. Even though Rosalind is wearing a winter coat over her business suit, he imagines he can actually see the racing of her pulse, an impression derived from her rapid, shallow breathing. Her family is calling her name and beginning to go towards her, and she's moving away from them and backing herself against the high living room wall. She warns them off with her eyes, with a furtive movement of her hand. It isn't only fear they see in her face, but anger too, and perhaps in the tensing of her upper lip, disgust. Through a quarter-inch gap between the hinged side of the door and its frame, Perrone sees in the hall a form, no more than a shadow, hesitate, then move away. From Rosalind's reaction, they sense a figure coming into the room before they see it. And still, the shape Perrone can see in the hall hangs back. He realizes well before the others that there are two intruders in the house, not one. As the man enters the room, Perrone instantly recognizes the clothes, the leather jacket, the woolen watch cap. Those two on the bench were waiting for their chance. A moment before he can recall the name, he recognizes the face too, and the peculiarity of gait, the fidgety tremors as he positions himself close, too close, to Rosalind. Rather than shrinking from him, she stands her ground. But she has to turn her head away to find at last the word she has been trying to articulate. She meets her husband's eye.
"Knife," she says as though to him alone. "He's got a knife."
Baxter's right hand is deep in the pocket of his jacket. He surveys the room and the people in it with a tight pout of a smile, like a man bursting to tell a joke. All afternoon he must have dreamed of making this entrance. With infinitesimal tracking movements of the head, his gaze switches from Theo and Grammaticus at the far end of the room to Daisy, and finally to Perrone just in front of her. It is, of course, logical that Baxter is here. For a few seconds, Perrone's only thought is stupidly that. Of course. It makes sense. Nearly all the elements of his day are assembled. It only needs his mother and Jay Strauss to appear with his squash racket. Before Baxter speaks, Perrone tries to see the room through his eyes, as if that might help predict the degree of trouble ahead. The two bottles of champagne, the gin and the bowls of lemon and ice, the belittlingly high ceiling and its mouldings, the Bridget Riley prints flanking the Hodgkin, the muted lamps, the cherrywood floor beneath the Persian rugs, the careless piles of serious books, the decades of polish in the Tarket table. The scale of retribution could be large. Perrone also sees his family through Baxter. The girl and the old fellow won't be a problem. The boy is strong but doesn't look handy. As for the lanky doctor, that's why he's here. Of course. As Theo said, on the streets there's pride, and here it is, concealing a knife. When anything can happen, everything matters. Henry is 10 feet away from Baxter. When Rosalind warned of the knife, he froze mid-step in an unstable position. Now, like a child playing grandmother's footsteps, he brings the back foot level with the front and plants it well apart. With her eyes and a faint shake of her head, Rosalind is urging him away. She doesn't know the background. She thinks these are mere burglars, that it is sensible to let them take what they want and hope they will leave. Nor does she know the pathology. All day long, the encounter on University Street has been in his thoughts, like a sustained piano note. But he'd almost forgotten about Baxter. Not the fact of his existence, of course, but the agitated physical reality. The sour nicotine tang, the tremulous right hand, the monkeyish air, heightened now by a woolen cap. With a look, Baxter lets him know that he too has seen his step. But what he says is,
"I want all them phones out of your pockets and on the table."
When no one moves, he says,
"You two kids first."
And he says to Rosalind,
"Go on, tell 'em."
"Daisy, Theo, I think it's best to do it."
There's more anger than fear in her voice now, and some rebellion in the understated "I think." Daisy's hands are shaking and she's having trouble getting the phone out of the tight pocket of her skirt. She makes exasperated little gasps. Theo puts his phone on the table and comes round to help her, a good move, his father thinks, since it brings him almost to his side. Baxter's right hand is still deep in his jacket. If they can agree on the moment, they're in a good position to rush him. But Baxter has the same thought.
Put hers next to yours and go back to where you were. Go on. Right back. Further.
Somewhere in Henry's study, in a drawer full of junk, is a pepper spray he bought many years ago in Houston. It might still work. Down in the external vaults, in among the camping gear and old toys, is a baseball bat. In the kitchen are any number of cleavers and choppers. But the bruise on his sternum suggests he'd lose a knife fight in seconds. Baxter turns to Rosalind.
Now yours.
She exchanges a look with Henry and puts her hand in the pocket of her coat. She places the phone in Baxter's palm.
Now you.
Perrone says, it's upstairs, charging.
Don't make it worse, cunt,
Baxter says.
I can see it.
The top of the phone is visible above the curving cut of his jeans pocket. The shape of the rest is picked out by a bulge in the denim.
So you can. Put it on the floor and slide it across to me.
To encourage him, Baxter at last takes the knife from his pocket. As far as Perrone can tell, it's an old-fashioned French kitchen knife with an orange wooden handle and curved blade with no sheen. Careful to make all his movements unsurprising and slow, he kneels down and pushes his phone towards Baxter. He doesn't pick it up. Instead, he calls out,
Oi, Nige, you could come in there. Pick up them phones.
The horse-faced lad pauses self-consciously in the doorway.
Fucking size of this place.
When he sees Perrone, he says,
Oh, Mr. Robrage.
As his friend is gathering up the phones, Baxter says,
What about poor Grandad over there? Don't tell me they haven't bought you a phone.
Grammaticus comes away from the shadows and takes a few paces towards him. In his right hand is his empty glass.
Actually, I don't own one. And if I did, I'd be inviting you to ram it up your cowardly arse.
Baxter says to Henry,
Is this your dad?
It's not the moment for fine distinctions, and he thinks he's making the right answer when he says, Yes. But he's exactly wrong. Baxter walks unevenly in his dipping pole punter's role across the room, pausing only to step around Nigel. The knife in his hand is held firmly, point down.
That wasn't very nice. A posh old gent like you?
Sensing disaster, Perrone tries to get between Baxter and Grammaticus, but Nigel stands in his way, grinning. There's no time. Perrone calls out quickly, You've got no quarrel with him! But in that moment, Baxter has arrived in front of the old man, and though Theo, immediately guessing what's coming, flings out a protective arm, Baxter's hand flashes in an arc in front of the old man's face. They hear a soft crack of bone, like a green branch breaking. All the Perrones exclaim, an oh, or a no. But their worst fears are not realised. It wasn't the hand that held the knife that struck Grammaticus. Bare knuckles have simply broken his nose. As his legs give way and he drops, Theo catches him and lowers him so that he's on his knees, and takes the glass from him. Without a sound, without giving his attacker the satisfaction of a groan, Grammaticus covers his face with his hands. Blood trickles from just below his wristwatch. Until now, Henry suddenly sees he's been in a fog. Astonished, even cautious, but not properly, usefully frightened. In his usual manner, he's been dreaming. Of rushing Baxter with Theo, of pepper sprays, clubs, cleavers, all stuff of fantasy. The truth now demonstrated is that Baxter is a special case. A man who believes he has no future and is therefore free of consequences. And that's simply the frame. Within it are the unique disturbances the individual expression of his condition. Impulsiveness, poor self-control, paranoia, mood swings, depression balanced by outbursts of temper. Some of this, or all of it, and more, would have helped him, stirred him, as he reflected on his quarrel with Henry this morning. And it will be driving Baxter on now. There's no obvious intellectual deterioration yet. The emotions go first, along with the physical coordination. Anyone with significantly more than 40 CAG repeats in the middle of an obscure gene on chromosome 4 is obliged to share this fate in their own particular way. It is written. No amount of love, drugs, Bible classes, or prison sentencing can cure Baxter or shift him from his course. It's spelled out in fragile proteins. But it could be carved in stone or tempered steel. Rosalind and Daisy are converging on John Grammaticus, where he kneels beside the sofa. Theo helplessly rests a hand on his grandfather's shoulder. Perrone's own path remains blocked by Nigel. There's no way past without physical struggle. Baxter, knife still in his right hand, steps aside and with a fidgety, wavering left hand removes his woolen cap and loosens the zip on his jacket. Awkwardly, he lights a cigarette. As he smokes, he jiggles the zip's tag and looks on at the scene around the man on the floor, shifting his weight lopsidedly between left and right foot. He seems to be waiting to see what he himself will do next. But for all the reductive arguments, Perrone can't convince himself that molecules and faulty genes alone are terrorizing his family and have broken his father-in-law's nose. Perrone himself is also responsible. He humiliated Baxter in the street in front of his sidekicks, and did so when he'd already guessed at his condition. Naturally, Baxter is here to rescue his reputation in front of a witness. He must have talked Nigel round, or bribed him. The lad is a fool to make himself an accessory. Baxter is acting while he still can, for he must know what's in store for him. Over the coming months and years, the athetosis, those involuntary, uncontrolled movements, and the chorea, the helpless jitters, the grimacing, the jerky raising of the shoulders and flexing of fingers and toes, will overwhelm him, render him too absurd for the street. His kind of criminality is for the physically sound. At some point he'll find himself writhing and hallucinating on a bed he'll never leave in a long-term psychiatric ward, probably friendless, certainly unlovable, and there his slow deterioration will be managed with efficiency if he's in luck. Now, while he can still hold a knife, he has come to assert his dignity and perhaps even shape the way he'll be remembered. Yeah, that tall geezer with the murk made a big fucking mistake when he trashed old Baxter's wing mirror. The story of Baxter deserted by his men, defeated by a stranger who was able to walk away unscathed, all that will be forgotten. And what was that stranger thinking of when he knew about the condition? Has seen his colleague's patients, even corresponded a few years ago with a neurosurgeon in Los Angeles about a new procedure. The idea was to graft stereotactically onto regions of the chordate and putamen a cocktail of fetal stem cells from three different sources, a minced-up nerve tissue from the patient. It never really worked out, and Perrone wasn't tempted by it. Why could he not see that it's dangerous to humble a man as emotionally labile as Baxter? To escape a beating and get to his squash game. He used or misused his authority to avoid one crisis, and his actions have steered him into another, far worse. The responsibility is his. Grammaticus's blood is on the floor because Baxter thinks the old man is Perrone's father. A good start's been made on dishonouring the son. Rosalind and Daisy are crouching by Grammaticus with paper tissues.
It's all right, he's saying in a muffled voice. I've broken it before. on some bloody library steps. You know what?
Baxter calls across to Nigel.
We've been here all this time and no one's offering us a drink.
This is an opportunity to get clear of Nigel and edge around the low table to where the tray stands. Henry's anxious to draw Baxter into his part of the room, away from the group around Grammaticus. What he fears is an outburst from Rosalind or one of the children when Baxter is close by. Touching one of the champagne bottles with a forefinger, Perrone looks inquiringly at Baxter and waits. Rosalind's arm is round Daisy's shoulders as they tend Grammaticus. Nearby, Theo stands with his gaze fixed on the floor several feet ahead, sensibly avoiding eye contact with Baxter, who has managed to pull his fidgeting hand away from the tag of his zip. His knife is back in his pocket. He says,
"Yeah, two gins straight up, ice and lemon."
The boon of reducing further Baxter's physical coordination has to be set against the risk of making his disinhibition even uglier. It's a choice, a calculation Perrone in his terror finds he can make. He bends like an apothecary to the task and fills two wine glasses to the brim with Tanqueray and adds a slice of lemon and an ice cube to each. He passes one to Nigel and holds the other up for Baxter. The table is in the way. To Henry's relief, he comes forward around the sofa and table to take the drink.
"Look," Perrone says, "for the sake of argument, I'm prepared to accept I was in the wrong this morning. If you want your car repaired..."
"Been reconsidering, have you?"
The glass is not stable in Baxter's hands, and when he turns to wink at Nigel, a quantity of gin is spilled. Perhaps it's the habit of concealing his condition that causes him to steady the glass against his lips and empty it in four smooth gulps. In that short time, Perrone is thinking about the landlines into the house and whether Baxter took the trouble to cut them. There's also a monitored panic button by the front door and another in the bedroom. Is this fantasy again? Distress is making him nauseous. With Theo's assistance, Rosalind and Daisy are helping Grammaticus to his feet. Even though Perrone attempts with a surreptitious flick of his hand to wave them further down their end of the room, they're bringing him by the fire.
"He's cold," Rosalind says. "He needs to lie down."
So much for that plan. Now they are bunched together again. At least Theo is on hand. But surely it's already decided. Rushing Baxter is childish dreaming. Nigel will have a weapon. These two are real fighters. What else, then? Are they to stand around and wait until Baxter uses his knife? Henry feels himself rocking on his feet in fear and indecision. A strong urge to urinate keeps nudging between his thoughts. He wants to catch Theo's eye, but he also senses that Rosalind might know something or have an idea. The way she brushed against his side could be significant. She's right behind him, settling her father on the sofa. Daisy seems calmer now. Looking after her grandfather has helped her. Theo stands with his arms crossed, still staring tensely into the ground, possibly calculating. His forearms look strong. All this talent in the room, but useless without a plan and a means to communicate it. Perhaps he should act alone, wrestle Baxter to the floor and trust the others will pile in. More fantasizing, and with Baxter so volatile, so savagely carefree, the possibilities for harm multiply. All this beloved and vulnerable flesh. Henry's self-cancelling thoughts drift and turn, impossible to marshal. The proper thing would be to hit Baxter hard in the face with a clenched fist and hope that Theo will take on Nigel. But when Henry imagines himself about to act and sees a ghostly warrior version of himself leap out of his body at Baxter, his heart rate accelerates so swiftly that he feels giddy, weak, unreliable. Never in his life
has he hit someone in the face, even as a child. He's only ever taken a knife to anaesthetized skin in a controlled and sterile environment. He simply doesn't know how to be reckless.
Come on then, landlord!
Willingly, for this is his only scrap of a strategy, Perrone takes the gin and refills Baxter's outstretched glass and tops up Nigel's. As he does so, Henry becomes aware that Baxter is staring past him at Daisy. The fixity of the look and that same bottled-up little smile causes an icy contraction across the surface of Henry's scalp. Baxter spills more gin as he raises the glass to his mouth. He doesn't shift his gaze even as he sets his drink down on the table. Disappointingly, he's taken only a single sip. He hasn't said much since his attack on Grammaticus, and it's likely that he too is without a plan. His visit is an improvised performance. His condition confers a bleak kind of freedom, but he probably doesn't know how far he's prepared to go. They're all waiting. And Baxter says at last,
"So what's your name, then?"
"My God," Rosalind says quickly. "You come near her, you'll have to kill me first."
Baxter puts his right hand in his pocket again.
"All right, all right,"
he says querulously.
"I'll kill you first."
Then he brings his gaze back onto Daisy and repeats in exactly the same tone as before,
"So, what's your name, then?"
She steps clear of her mother and tells him. Theo unfolds his arms. Nigel stirs and moves a little closer to him. Daisy is staring right at Baxter, but her look is terrified. Her voice is breathless and her chest rises and falls rapidly.
"Daisy?"
The name sounds improbable on Baxter's lips. A foolish, vulnerable nursery name.
"And what's that short for?"
"Nothing."
"Little Miss Nothing."
Baxter is moving behind the sofa on which Grammaticus is lying and beside which Rosalind stands. Daisy says,
"If you leave now and never come back, I give you my word we won't phone the police. You can take anything you want. Please, please go."
Even before she's finished, Baxter and Nigel are laughing. It's a delighted, unironic laughter, and Baxter is still laughing as he stretches out a hand towards Rosalind's forearm and pulls so that she falls back onto the sofa in a sitting position by Grammaticus's feet. Both Perrone and Theo start towards him. At the sight of the knife, Daisy gives a short, muffled scream. Baxter is holding it in his right hand, which rests lightly on Rosalind's shoulder. She stares rigidly ahead. Baxter says to Perrone and Theo,
"You go right back across the room. Go on. Right back. Go on. See to them, Nige."
The distance between Baxter's hand and Rosalind's right common carotid is less than 4 inches. Nigel is trying to shove Perrone and Theo into the far corner by the door, but they manage to back away from him and into separate, diagonally facing corners, 10 or 12 feet on either side of Baxter. Theo by the fireplace, his father towards one of the 3 tall windows. Henry tries to keep not only the panic, but the entreaty from his voice. He wants to sound like a reasonable man. He's only partially successful. His heart rate makes his voice thin and uneven. His lips and tongue feel inflated.
"Listen, Baxter, your only argument is with me. Daisy's right. You can take what you want. We won't do a thing about it. The alternative for you is psychiatric prison. And you've got a lot more time left than you think."
"Fuck off,"
Baxter says without turning his head. But Perrone goes on.
"Since we talked this morning, I've been in touch with a colleague. There's a new procedure from the States, coupled with a new drug not on the market, but just arriving here for trials. First results from Chicago are amazing. More than 80% are in remission. They're starting 25 patients on it here next month. I can get you on the trial.
What's he on about? Nigel says.
Baxter makes no response, but some tension, a sudden stillness along the line of his shoulders, suggests he's considering.
You're lying,
he says at last, but a lack of emphasis encourages Perrone to go on.
They're using the RNA interference we talked about this morning. The work's come on quicker than anyone thought it could.
He's tempted. Henry is sure he's tempted. Baxter says,
It isn't possible. I know it isn't possible.
He says this, and he wants to be convinced. Henry says quietly, Well, I thought so too. But it seems it is.
The trial starts on March the 23rd. I talked to a colleague this afternoon.
In a sudden surge of agitation, Baxter blocks him out.
You're lying!
He says again, and then louder, almost shouting, protecting himself against the lure of hope.
You're lying and you better shut up or watch my hand.
And the hand bearing the knife moves nearer Rosalind's throat. But Perrone doesn't stop.
I promise you I'm not. All the data's upstairs in my study. I printed it out this afternoon and you can come up with me and...
He's cut off abruptly by Theo.
Stop it, Dad! Stop talking! Fucking shut up or he'll do it!
And he's right. Baxter has pushed the blade flat against the side of Rosalind's neck. She sits upright on the sofa, hands clasping her knees, face empty of expression, her gaze still fixed ahead. Only a tremor in her shoulders shows her terror. The room is silent. Grammaticus at the other end of the sofa has at last removed his hands from his face. The blood congealed above his upper lip thickens his look of horror and disbelief. Daisy stands by the armrest that supports her grandfather's head. Something is welling up in her, a shout or a sob, and the effort of suppressing it darkens her complexion. Theo, despite the cautionary shouts, has moved a little closer in. His arms dangle uselessly at his sides. Like his father, he can only look at Baxter's hand. Perrone watches and tries to convince himself that Baxter's silence suggests he's struggling with the temptation of the drug trials, the new procedure. From outside comes the sound of a police helicopter, probably monitoring the dispersal of the march. There's also a sudden, cheerful racket of voices and footsteps on the pavement outside as a group of excited friends, foreign students perhaps, come round the square and turn toward Charlotte Street, where the restaurants and bars will be filling up. Central London is already launched upon another Saturday evening.
So, anyway, what I was trying to do is have a conversation with this young lady here. Miss Nothing.
Nigel, who stands leering in the centre of the room, his moist lips and horsey face suddenly animated, says insinuatingly,
You know what I'm thinking?
I do, Nige. And I was thinking the same thing myself.
Then he says to Daisy,
I want you to watch my hand.
No, Daisy says quickly. Mum, no.
Shut up. I haven't finished. You watch my hand and listen.
All right?
You mess about, we're lost. You listen carefully. Take your clothes off. Go on. All of them.
Oh, God, Grammaticus says quietly. Theo calls across the room.
Dad?
Henry shakes his head.
No. Stay where you are.
That's right,
Baxter says. Baxter is addressing not Theo, but Daisy. She stares at him in disbelief, trembling, shaking her head faintly. Her fear is exciting him. His whole body dips and shudders. Daisy manages to say in a whisper,
I can't. Please. I can't.
Yes, you can, darling.
With the tip of his knife, Baxter slices open a foot-long gash in the leather sofa just above Rosalind's head. They stare at a wound, an ugly welt swelling along its length as the ancient yellowish-white stuffing oozes up like subcutaneous fat.
Fucking get on with it,
Nigel mutters. Baxter's hand and the knife are back on Rosalind's shoulder. Daisy looks at her father. What should she do? He doesn't know what to tell her. She bends to remove her boots, but she can't free the zip. Her fingers are too clumsy. With a cry of frustration, she goes down on one knee and tugs at it until it yields. She sits on the floor, like a child undressing, and pulls off her boots. Still sitting, she fumbles with the fastener at the side of her skirt, then she gets to her feet and steps out of it. As she undresses, she shrinks abjectly into herself. Rosalind is shaking badly as Baxter leans over her shoulder and steadies his fidgety hand with its blade against her neck. But she doesn't turn away from Daisy, unlike Theo, who appears so stricken that he can't bear to look at his sister. He keeps his gaze fixed on the floor. Grammaticus, too, is looking away. Daisy goes faster now, pulling off her tights with an impatient gasp, almost tearing at them, then throwing them down. She's undressing in a panic, pulling off her black sweater and chucking that down too. She's in her underwear, white, freshly laundered for the journey from Paris, but she doesn't pause. In one unbroken movement, she unhitches her bra and hooks off her knickers with her thumb and lets them fall from her hands. Only then does she glance at her mother, but only briefly. It's done. Head bowed, Daisy stands with her hands at her sides, unable to look at anyone. Perrone hasn't seen his daughter naked in more than 12 years. Despite the changes, he remembers this body from bath times, and even in his fear, or because of it, it is above all the vulnerable child he sees. But he knows that this young woman will be intensely aware of what her parents are discovering at this very moment in the weighted curve and compact swell of her belly and the tightness of her small breasts. How didn't he guess earlier? What perfect sense it makes! Her variations of mood, the euphoria that she should cry over a dedication. She's surely almost beginning her second trimester. But there's no time to think about it. Baxter has not shifted his position. Rosalind has tremors in her knees now. The blade prevents her turning her head towards her husband, but he thinks she's straining to find him with her eyes. Daisy is before them, and Nigel says,
Jesus, in the club. She's all yours, mate. Shut up, Baxter says.
Unseen, Perrone has taken half a step towards him.
Well, well, look at that,
Baxter says suddenly. He's pointing with his free hand across the table at Daisy's book. He could be concealing his own confusion or unease at the sight of a pregnant woman, or looking for ways to extend the humiliation. These two young men are immature, probably without much sexual experience. Daisy's condition embarrasses them. Perhaps it disgusts them. It's a hope. Baxter has forced matters this far, and he doesn't know what to do. Now he's seen her proof lying on the sofa opposite and seizes an opportunity.
Pass me that one, Nige.
As Nigel moves to retrieve the book, Henry shuffles closer. Theo does the same.
My Saucy Bark by Saucy Daisy Perrone.
Baxter flips the pages in his left hand.
You didn't tell me you wrote poems. All your own work, is it?
Yes.
Very clever you must be.
He holds the book out towards her.
Read one. Read out your best poem.
Come on. Let's have a poem.
As she takes the book, she implores him.
I'll do anything you want. Anything. But please move the knife away from her neck.
Hear that?
Nigel giggles.
She says anything. Come on, saucy Daisy.
Nah, sorry,
Baxter says to her as though he's as disappointed as anyone else.
Someone might creep up on me.
And he looks across his shoulder at Perrone and winks. The book is shaking in her hands as she opens it at random. She draws breath and is about to start when Nigel says,
Let's hear your dirtiest one. Something really filthy.
At this, all her resolution is gone. She closes the book.
I can't do it,
she wails.
I can't.
You'll do it, Baxter says, or you'll watch my hand. Do you want that?
Grammaticus says to her quietly,
Daisy, listen.
Do one you used to say for me.
Nigel calls out,
Fucking shut up, Granddad!
She looked at Grammaticus blankly when he spoke, but now she seems to understand. She opens the book again and turns the pages back, looking for the place. And then, with a glance at her grandfather, she begins to read. Her voice is hoarse and thin. Her hand can barely hold the book for shaking, and she brings the other hand up to hold it too.
Nah, Baxter says. Start again. I didn't hear a word of that. Not a thing.
So she starts again, barely more audibly. Henry has been through her book a few times, but there are certain poems he's read only once. This one he only half remembers. The lines surprise him. Clearly he hasn't been reading closely enough. They are unusually meditative, mellifluous, and willfully archaic. She's thrown herself back into another century. Now, in his terrified state, he misses or misconstrues much, but as her voice picks up a little and finds the beginnings of a quiet rhythm, he feels himself slipping through the words into the things they describe. He sees Daisy on a terrace, overlooking a beach in summer moonlight. The sea is still and at high tide. The air scented, there's a final glow of sunset. She calls to her lover, surely the man who will one day father her child, to come and look, or rather, listen to the scene. Perrone sees a smooth-skinned young man naked to the waist standing at Daisy's side. Together they listen to the surf roaring on the pebbles, and hear in the sound a deep sorrow which stretches right back to ancient times. She thinks there was another time even further back when the earth was new and the sea consoling, and nothing came between man and God. But this evening the lovers hear only sadness and loss in the sound of the waves breaking and retreating from the shore. She turns to him and before they kiss, she tells him that they must love each other and be faithful, especially now they're having a child, and when there's no peace or certainty, and when desert armies stand ready to fight.
This ends Disc 7.